Today is August the 15th, 2018. Do you know who has your personal data? Let me ask the question differently. Do you know who's using your personal data? Welcome to the Personal Computer Show. This is the original personal computer radio show of all things computing. I'm Hank Key, my colleague is Joe King, and podcast of the program is available on wbai.org/archive, also on prn.fm, and on our website, pcradioshow.org. We are on WBAI-FM, 99.5 on the radio, and prn.fm on the internet each Wednesday with essentially the same program, except when WBAI is in a membership drive. Twenty-five Android smartphones from well-known brands come with severe vulnerabilities pre-installed. It's one thing to discover you've installed malware on your phone while sideloading an app that you thought it was safe to use. And it's quite another to find out that your phone was shipped with preloaded vulnerabilities that would allow third parties to spy on you. Yes, it does happen. What's more disturbing is that some of the well-known Android vendors out there include preloaded security issues. Researchers from CryptoWare discovered some 38 vulnerabilities in preloaded apps that reside in the firmware builds of 25 Android handsets, including 11 models that are sold in the United States. Here's a list of Android vendors affected, which includes Asus, Essential, LG, Nokia, Sony, and ZTE. For example, in the Asus Zenfone 3 Max, attackers could use a flawed pre-installed app to access system data and Wi-Fi passwords. It's also possible to execute code through a wireless connection. The Essential phone, meanwhile, comes with a pre-installed app that would allow any app to wipe all user data via factory reset. The LG G6 packs a bunch of issues itself, including a vulnerability that can lock a user out of their phone and force the user to do a factory reset in recovery mode. The same phone can be used to gain the kernel log. The Nokia 6 and the Sony Xperia L1 comes with issues that will allow attackers to capture screenshots quietly. The ZTE Z Max Pro allow hackers to steal text messages and even edit or send them without your knowledge. The security researchers have notified all manufacturers as well as Google Android vendors, including Asus, Essential, and LG have either deployed fixes or will do it. Meanwhile, Google explained that the issues do not affect the Android operating systems, but they do affect the third-party code and application on devices. Google is working with CryptoWare to address the issue. If you own one of the phones mentioned above, make sure you install the latest updates, and if you're worried about your data, contact the manufacturer for more information. And here's a word of advice if you're looking to buy a new phone. If you can afford it, try to buy the phone unlocked so that these vulnerable apps are not pre-installed on the phone. The problem of robocalling is getting worse. In April, robocall blocking service Umail estimated 3.4 billion such calls were made, 900 million more than the month over the same period in 2017. The FCC is taking steps to fix the influx of robo-spam, but thus far it's only addressing part of the problem. If it's you on the receiving end of a seemingly never-ending barrage of, scam robocalls, a fix couldn't come soon enough. Some smartphone owners should get a respite from this issue thanks to Google. Google recently updated its Android phone app to automatically filter out calls it identifies as spam. The app will automatically send these calls straight to your voicemail without ringing your device. This means that if the caller decides to leave a voicemail, like the IRS is coming after you and you better act fast, you'll still receive it. However, your day won't be interrupted by your phone ringing or vibrating, and that's certainly a boon. If you're on an Android phone running Android 6.0 or later, you can turn this feature on by heading to the phone app, tapping the setting icon in the upper right, then selecting caller ID and spam, then toggle on filter spam calls. The latest update is an upgrade over Google's previous efforts at sorting spam. Until now, its phone app has been able to identify suspected spam calls via caller ID. When one of these known numbers called your number, your phone would ring, but the screen would turn red with the words suspected spam caller. The screen also showed a reminder that you could swipe downward to reject the call. The new call filtering feature is an extension of this work, and according to Google, it's one of the Android phone app most popular features. It was a natural next step to improve the experience even further to reduce the distraction and hassle of receiving a spam call. Unfortunately, stopping one of the latest trends in spam and robocalling, neighbor spoofing, is still a work in progress. Neighbor spoofing happens when a caller modifies what displays on caller ID, making a phone call, well, appear local. The recipient is more likely to answer since the call looks like it could be from a neighbor, a colleague, or an area business. These calls are more difficult to identify since they look like they could originate from a legitimate source rather than a previously reported spam phone number. Still, Google's recent moves are more than what's being done on competing operating systems. On iOS, your only option for filtering and identifying spam phone callers is to use a third-party app. While it's not necessarily difficult to set up an app like Truecaller, which is free, or Robocaller, which costs about $250 a month, it is an extra hassle and potentially an extra expense, depending on which app you download. Your other alternative is to use a service like T-Mobile's Scam ID and Scam Block, which is free, or Verizon's Caller Name ID, which is about $3 a month, to help filter and identify robocalls on your carrier's end. Some phone makers, such as Samsung, also offer built-in features for identifying blocking spam calls. Even with tools like these in place, defeating spam and robocalls feel like an uphill battle. While consumers are crying against the practice, major corporations such as SiriusXM, Capital One, and others are lobbying the administration to slacken its robocall policies. Proposed changes would mean the consumer would have no legal right to demand these kind of incessant calls stop. But as the FCC continues to debate the issue of robocalls and spam, consumers have at least a few options for stemming the flow. And just to let everyone know, robocalls are not banned if they are from nonprofits or, of course, your favorite friend, the politician. Google has issued a new rule for Android phones. Two notches? Okay. Three notches? Uh-uh. Notches are a fixture on today's smartphones. Rather than a thick black bar across the top and bottom of a device, phone makers have opted to extend the screen as high as possible to maximize real estate. But since we still have cameras and other sensors on the front of the device, a cutout, a notch, that's what they're calling it, typically needs to jut downwards into the display. Apple's iPhone X, while not the first to feature design, was the one that mainstreamed it. There are now 16-notch Android devices available from 11 manufacturers. This week, Google finally published its guidelines on the controversial smartphone element, and it included a curious direction. Google set a few guidelines for how phone makers should implement notches on Android handsets. While we've only seen single cutout phones so far, Android is putting the kibosh on devices that plan to have more than two notches. Three is one notch too many. Apparently, Google also set stipulations that these notches can only be positioned on the top and bottom of the device screen and that there can only be one cutout per short edge of the device. Google said the cutout must not negatively affect apps. Well, that's for Android phones. Will Apple come up with similar design requirement? They can do anything they want. They design the iPhone, and they'll design it the way they want it. The top pay TV providers now account for about 92 million subscribers, with the top six cable companies having 48 million video subscribers. Satellite TV services have 31 million subscribers, and the top telephone companies about 9 million subscribers. And the top internet-delivered pay TV services accounts for about 4 million subscribers. Well, this was just recently released. The top six cable companies lost about 285,000 video subscribers in the first quarter of this year, compared to a loss of 115,000 subscribers last year. The top telephone providers lost about 50,000 video subscribers in the first quarter of this year, compared to 325,000 subscribers last year. AT&T, well, they didn't provide any figures. Internet-delivered services like Sling TV and DirecTV now added over 400,000 subscribers just in the first quarter of this year, compared to 265,000 net added in the first quarter of last year. Traditional pay TV services, not including internet-delivered services, lost about 710,000 subscribers in the first quarter of this year, compared to a loss of about 780,000 in a similar period last year. The numbers are in. The number of pay TV subscribers for the top providers peaked 6 years ago. That was back in the first quarter of 2012. Top providers have since lost about 3.4 million total pay TV subscribers, mostly just last year. Americans have already scrapped traditional pay TV services, and the exodus is expected to continue at a much more rapid pace in the year 2018. This year, the number of cord cutters in the United States will climb to 33 million adults, according to new estimates from research firm eMarketer. That compared with a total of 24 million cord cutters the end of last year. Wow, that's a lot. Cord cutting refers to the cancellation of multi-channel cable and other pay television subscription services by television viewers. The country's second largest cable company, Spectrum, said it lost 122,000 video subscribers in its first quarter. Shares of rivals likewise dropped, including Optimum, down 9.3%, Comcast, which admitted it lost about 96,000 subscribers in the most recent quarter. Telecom giant Verizon on Tuesday said it lost 22,000 net paid TV subscribers in the first quarter, compared with a loss of 13,000 a year ago. I have some solution on how these TV providers can stop this cord cutting. Simple. Cut your price. What the competition is offering is the same content material you're offering, but at a much lower price. That's number one. And the second is they're not forced to accept 100 or 200 channels when they only want a few. Make it a la carte if you still want to retain your business. Gmail update your emails with conversation view option. Mobile Gmail is getting a desktop Gmail feature. Gmail is a webmail client, and it has just been the subject of a massive update and style makeover on mobile as well as on the desktop. Not all things are equal between desktop and mobile Gmail. Gmail has made conversation view optional on mobile devices, just like it is optional on the desktop. Long email conversation threads can grow quickly, whether you're re-emailing just one person or you're CCing the whole team, it doesn't matter. If the issue you're talking about is complex and has lots of details, you'll be going back and forth a lot. This can quickly lead to long, confusing threads that are easy to get lost in. If this sounds like a problem that you've come against, you may want to turn off Conversation View. When you turn off Conversation View, all of the emails you receive as part of a conversation will come through individually. Each email will show up in your inbox as a separate email. This could cause problems of its own if your re-email is quickly overrun by individual emails about the same issue. But at least now email mobile users now have a choice. Well, how do you deactivate Conversation View on Gmail, iOS, and Android. All you have to do is turn off Conversation View on mobile, is click your account name in the corner and then scroll down to Settings. When you open the Settings menu, one of the first options you'll see will be Conversation View option. Just uncheck the box and you're good to go. Has Amazon's Alexa been coming on when you didn't ask for it at all? Well, digital assistants like Amazon Alexa and Google Assistant are designed to learn more about you as they listen. And part of doing so is to record conversations you've had with them to learn your tone of voice, prompts, and requests. Recently, this feature is not a bug, has landed Amazon in a string of bizarre headlines. A couple months ago, in March, users reported that their Echo speakers began spontaneously laughing. And more recently, a family in Portland said their device recorded and sent conversations to a colleague without their knowledge. For these instances, Amazon claims that the devices were likely triggered by false positive commands. It's not uncommon for smart speakers to pick up a random part of your everyday conversation and misunderstand it as a wake word, especially if you may have changed the Alexa trigger by a more common word like anything you like, computer, or anything else you want. If you're curious about what Alexa has been hearing and recording in your household, here's a quick way to check. First, open the Alexa app on your smart device. Tap the hamburger icon on the top left side of the screen to open the menu options. Click on the Settings menu, then find History. Here you'll be able to browse all the commands you've ever asked of Alexa, from the time of day to the weather, music requests, and other general internet queries. You can also sort the results by date. Sometimes you may even see just a line that says Alexa. For those times, you may have mentioned the assistant's name but didn't mean to actually use it. You may notice a few instances where the Alexa app notes a text not available. Click on this and you can listen to a recording of what you or someone in your household said that prompted the Echo to listen to your current conversation. If you're uncomfortable having any particular recording in your Alexa history, you can delete it on an individual basis or go to the Amazon Manage Your Content and Devices page to wipe it entirely. The company, of course, cautions that doing so may degrade your Alexa experience. Alexa keeps these recordings to personalize the Alexa experience to your household and use them to create an acoustic model of your voice. While it does automatically create a voice profile for each new user, it recognizes all the ones that you manually added. The company says it deletes acoustic models if it's not been recognized in any particular use for 3 years. For heavy Alexa users, going through all these commands to find conversations that you want deleted may be too much work. But if you're nervous about what the Echo has been listening to say, hey, it may be well worth browsing and it's worth your time to delete something that's recorded that you don't want to be available elsewhere. And now from Dr. Alfred Poor, a feature segment on the following subjects: self-healing electrical conductive material, fast growth forecast for smart patches, an augmented reality app helps autism patients.
Hello, this is Alfred Poor with news about wearables and digital health technology from Health Tech Insider.
Hello, this is Alfred Poor, and I'm glad to say that I'm back. There's been a bit of a hiatus this summer, but I believe that's all behind us, and I should be back with my weekly segments for the Personal Computer Show going forward. So, without any further ado, let's get started. The first story tonight is a bit unusual. It's a geeky technology story. You know, that's the kind of thing I love. It's about a new conductive material. Now, flexible electronics are going to be very important in the whole wearable healthcare and medicine kind of applications. We need smart devices that can conform to bodies and keep working even when the body moves and it changes shape. And so this is all very important. But one of the problems is that if you're wearing something on your body, like your skin, it gets scraped, it gets cut, it gets bruised. you need to come up with technology that's going to be able to absorb that kind of damage and keep on working, because these things are going to be entrusted with getting data about our health and our medical conditions. You're essentially entrusting them with our lives. So they've got to be reliable. And you can't have wires flexing and then breaking because they've been bent too many times. Well, researchers at Carnegie Mellon College of Engineering have come up with a new material, and it's kind of interesting. It's a flexible conductor, highly conductive, and it even remains conductive if you stretch it, which is important when you're going to bend it around a body part. It's more than that, though. It also is self-healing. If you should slice it and break the circuit will actually heal itself and continue working. How does it do this? Well, it's actually a mix of liquid metal mixed into a plastic, a flexible plastic. And of course, you had me at liquid metal. That's just too cool. But basically, they're tiny droplets that are embedded in the material. And when there's a cut, those tiny little droplets rupture and the metal flows to connect with other droplets to reestablish the circuit. And so it's able to maintain the electrical connection and keep on working. Just if you slice it with a knife, that's pretty impressive that it keeps on working. But there's more. You can take a paper punch and punch a hole in these circuits and they'll keep on working. You can take a knife and cut out a whole chunk of the circuit and it'll keep on working. It's amazing. You've got to see this for yourself. Go to the healthtechinsider.com site and you can see a video of a little robot after it's been terribly abused by holes being punched in it. It keeps on working. So this is kind of remarkable. The general point here, though, is that materials research is going to be a really important part of all this development for wearable technology. And this flexible, self-healing electronic conductor material is just one example of the many kinds of advances we're going to be seeing in this area. As a kid, if you fall down, you skin your knee, you get a bandage. And it sits there and covers the cut, covers the scrape, keeps the dirt out, allows air in, helps speed healing, and it's all good. Looking forward, we're going to be expecting our bandages to do a whole lot more. Already, smart skin patches are doing amazing things in terms of monitoring heart conditions or recording important biomarker data that can help understand a patient's health or medical conditions. A company called ID TechX Research has recently released a report about the whole electronic skin patch market. They have decided, based on the research and where things are now and where they see things headed, they expect this market to grow to more than $10 billion in revenue a year by 2023. Just 5 years from now, and to reach almost $15 billion by 2028. Those are some big numbers, and it's a fast-growing industry. These smart patches are very valuable because they can incorporate sensors and data processing and a whole bunch of things. For example, they can monitor heart conditions and determine if a patient's heart rhythm is abnormal and needs attention, and can automatically generate an alert to warn healthcare providers that they need attention. Another possibility is to be able to measure glucose, blood glucose levels using a patch like this, which could give a way for patients to constantly monitor their blood sugar and presumably be able to tie that to an insulin pump so that they can constantly maintain their blood sugar at an appropriate level. So the point is that there are lots of applications for these devices, both in the hospital and for monitoring patients outside the hospital after discharge. As ID TechX has predicted, it's probably going to be a rapidly growing market segment. I've said it here before, and I'm going to say it again. The rumors of the death of Google Glass are greatly exaggerated. The fact is that augmented reality is gaining all kinds of traction in industrial applications and in operating rooms and in other kinds of settings. The fact is that augmented reality is also finding health and medical applications involving patients. One of the very interesting new developments is a company called BrainPower. They've created a system called Empower Me that relies on the artificial reality of Google Glass to help patients with autism spectrum disorder, ASD. These patients have a difficult time reading others, understanding people's emotions, staying engaged with their environment, their surroundings. This application for Google Glass actually uses gamification. They turn the exercises into games and helps the users to remain more engaged with their settings, to better understand the emotional reactions that they're getting from other people in their settings. The whole system uses artificial intelligence to help shape the activities that are presented to the individual based on their specific needs. Gamification is a big development, and now we see it being paired with augmented reality. This is a combination that could have a lot of applications in terms of treating a variety of disorders and conditions for patients.
For more information, go to healthtechinsider.com. This is Alfred Poor. Thanks for listening.
Thank you, Alfred. New Wi-Fi attacks and the need to upgrade to WPA3. Researchers looking into a more secure WPA3 Wi-Fi protocol have discovered a huge weakness in the current WPA2 standard. It's been reported that as the first WPA3 Wi-Fi devices were becoming available, a collective of tech companies called the Wi-Fi Alliance were beginning to certify devices with this new enhanced security protocol, which is very difficult for hackers to guess people's passwords. Now research in looking at WPA have found a new way to breach the current standard Wi-Fi formats of WPA and WPA2. A new method of attack puts your Wi-Fi network at risk. Although new WPA3 devices are starting to come on the scene, almost all Wi-Fi enabled devices still use WPA2. This latest vulnerability enables hackers to intercept sensitive information like passwords sent by WPA and WPA2 devices. The attack relies on non-traditional methods, which makes defending against it very difficult. The new WPA vulnerability, discovered while looking for potential gaps in WPA3, has identified pairwise master key identifiers that was insecure. It will be places like hospitals and schools that would be most vulnerable to WPA2 security shortcomings. Add this new threat to the massive crack vulnerability that was discovered last year, it's clear that the world needs to start adopting WPA3 much more quickly. At the time crack was discovered, every WPA2 enabled Wi-Fi device in the world and a plethora of tutorials, patches, and updates were needed to get back on top of things. This is the beginning to discontinue the use of WPA2. The big difference between WPA2 and WPA3 is individual data encryption. The scrambling of all communication between Wi-Fi devices makes it much more difficult to crack. According to researchers behind these new findings, this will make WPA3 immune to this new method of attack. We can expect that there will be a wider release of WPA3 certified devices this year. So it's time to start considering the replacement of a router that has WPA3 encryption capability. If Americans want fast internet access, they need to tighten the screws on big cable and not give it yet more power. That's the conclusion of another study into the United States broadband market. This time, one lodged in opposition to a push by big cable lobbying group U.S. Telecom to kill off a federal rule that enables smaller ISPs to compete against communication giants. Specifically, the rule, which is in the crosshair of U.S. Telecom, forces cable carriers to allow competitors to resell their internet access at a rate set by the government. The report digs into the reality and concludes that the requirement on incumbent cable companies to let rivals offer their own services through local exchanges is an important driver of real competition in the market. Most notably, the report, using figures supplied by the industry itself, concludes that competitors are significantly more likely to offer consumers better and faster internet access. As expected, incumbent local exchange carriers have a stranglehold over U.S. consumers' internet access. the competitive local exchange carriers without their own equipment in local exchanges, but who can resell the internet access over copper lines under their own brands. Amazingly, the competition is doing more than the actual companies that already have their equipment in the exchanges. Why? Because they know that people want faster internet access. And they're trying, despite being at a disadvantage, to offer that to the market. The argument and the reason for the rule, which is Section 251, is that such exchange is acting as stepping stones for other companies to build out their broadband services, so grow both their reach and their brand nationwide. Those competitors bring in revenue by reselling other companies' internet access, then use that money to pay to install their own fast equipment, that is to say, fiber, into the same exchanges. In other words, the system works, albeit somewhat slowly and efficiently. The competitive ISPs are migrating from base services to full facilities-based services by actively deploying fiber more so than the incumbent cable services. And what's more, those smaller competitors are much more aggressive with their fiber rollouts, convinced that it is their foothold into the market. The smallest competitive service reviewed, Monmouth, to date, provides broadband over its own fiber networks in 66% of the census blocks in which it provides service. The report noted, in terms of sheer scope of investment, Sonic, the largest competitive local carrier, has built out fiber to over 1,300 census blocks and has deployed more fiber since then. The report makes plain what numerous other probes into broadband access have noted, that the level of competition to ordinary consumers is dire. What that effectively means is that real competition between more than two companies that can offer their own services is almost non-existent, with just over 6% of exchanges capable of offering it. It gets worse. The lack of competition leads directly to a lack of broadband offering, and the upstarts are only companies that are offering broadband speeds, as defined by the FCC minimum of 25 megabits per second. The incumbents simply don't bother to offer faster speeds until they're pressured to do so by competition. Not only that, but the smaller competitors have invested more in comparative terms in new technology so that they can offer faster speeds over the same infrastructure as incumbent to give them a competitive edge. They have also used the federal pricing structure, where they pay just under $12 per line per month, to offer faster internet access by purchasing and effectively combining two lines, that means bonding pairs, and offering that faster speed seamlessly to subscribers at a higher price. If there was any doubt at all about how big cable feels about this, you need only consider the fact that the response of multi-billion dollar corporations to the nimble market approach has not been to invest their vast profits in upgrading technologies or exchanges, or offer lower prices or higher speeds, but to get their lobbyists in Washington, D.C. to push to kill off the federal rule that makes that limited degree of competition possible. And if you were in any doubt as to what would happen if the rules were killed off, you only consider the fact that the price that competitors would have to pay if it was killed off is confidential and much higher. The good thing about federal pricing structures is that you get to know what they are. A new report from the National Digital Inclusion Alliance points out that customers nationwide who still subscribe to the slow DSL home internet services, they're getting screwed over twice. First, with slow speeds, and secondly, with prices that, well, really don't make any sense. They charge the same price as regular high speed. AT&T still charges their DSL customers $60 a month for access to a service that varies between 6 megabits per second and 10 megabits per second down. And the report notes that at the same time, AT&T cable offering costs $60 per month for speeds upwards of 50 megabits per second. Verizon does something quite similar, charging its DSL customers $63 or $64 a month, while its 100 megabits fiber services is $65 a month. The term used by AT&T and Verizon is tier flattening, T-I-E-R, tier flattening. AT&T and Verizon home customers pay a high price for slow internet, and it is essentially a comparison of AT&T and Verizon DSL plans for their cable and fiber offerings. The term tier flattening refers to what the report found, charging nearly identical prices for vastly different levels of service. It is less about telecom companies overcharging for slow services, and rather an interesting look into why rural broadband is still so slow in America. Unfortunately, the economics of the telecom marketplace explain the problem of tier flattening. In urban areas where AT&T and Verizon face competition and need a network capable of serving a far denser population, the telecoms providers have no choice but to upgrade their copper line network to cable or fiber. If they fail to do so, they'll lose customers to competitors, whether that be a big cable company or a tiny local ISP. Competition is more prevalent in urban areas where building out a network with enough customers to achieve a minimum scale is easier and cheaper than doing so in rural areas. Outside of cities, telecom companies simply don't have a need to upgrade their networks. DSL internet might be slow and expensive, but it's still cheaper than wireless internet and far better than no internet at all. If a telecom company upgraded from DSL to fiber, it would be spending a lot of money to charge people virtually the same amount every month, since they'd be unable to charge customers on a farm hundreds of dollars more than what it charges its customers in the city. With no competition to drive investment in the network and no downwards pressure on prices, customers get stuck in the tier flattening rule. When you think about a house that's supposed to let you dodge major repairs or replacements over 40 years, it's easy enough to forgive the usual consumables, things like paper towels and furnace filters and water softener pellets. But there are several technology things in that limbo beyond consumables, but well before 40 years, that can become absolutely annoying. Things like batteries for backup power systems, or piezo wafers in transducers. Marty talks about the workarounds we can do and about why today manufacturers should pay more attention to softening the blow of future replacement chores.
The whole idea of designing a house that can go 40 years without major repairs or replacements. And yeah, even with the assistance of the cybernetics we're bringing into that design, well, it remains a lot more challenging than it needs to be. Simply because when you look at the goods and items from which homes are built, so many are compromised. I don't mean this to be a gripe fest. With luck, it's a bit of an awakening into a heightened perception of where things fall short and how they could be better. But hey, this isn't the personal Joist construction radio show, so let's set our focus on the technology elements of a home and where they fall short and how they could be better. My inspiration for this was a less than inspiring moment when within minutes of each other, two of my UPSs failed. These are line interactive models, so you would expect any failure to keep power going to the gear as long as it saw power at the plug. But at best, that failure mode only applies to the end of life of batteries. When it's the end of life for controllers, anything can happen. It not only doesn't have to be that way, it shouldn't be that way. The UPS is a good example of something that could and should be designed with any and every failure mode in mind. A UPS that might cost a few hundred dollars may seem expensive, but a PC with even mid-range horsepower can easily cost thousands. And the work that went into creating your content on that PC is probably worth more. Not to mention some content, like your photos, it's irreplaceable. Now, all of a sudden, another $5 or $10 in parts that weren't included starts looking like an exercise in, well, manufacturer irresponsibility. As you may remember hearing in my earlier segments, I was planning to use line interactive UPSs as the AC power route of the DC power buses in the house, with a computer PSU doing the conversion to DC. Now, instead, I'm using small enclosed DC power modules in a triply redundant setup. The clusters of three have two powered by a pair of UPSs and one powered directly by the line. Then all of their same voltage outputs get joined at the bus lines through Schottky diodes. With doubly redundant DC supplies, even if one UPS should fail, if the power also fails, the other UPS will keep things going. These can be the least expensive UPSs out there. The maximum load for each is only about 80 watts. The little DC supplies have a hold-up time. That means they act as if the power hasn't yet disappeared. A hold-up time about twice as long as it takes for a standby UPS to switch into a circuit. Even if the line power and both UPSs went suddenly kaput, the output capacitors inside the DC supplies could keep feeding needed voltages onto the bus lines for a couple of seconds, and that's longer than most power outages. But hang on a second. There's something else about UPSs that shouldn't escape your attention, especially in the way you may be using yours. Does it have a couple of RJ connectors that promise to surge protect either your Ethernet line or your phone line? Don't trust them. They work by connecting the input jack to the output jack through Schottky diodes on every line in that connection. A Schottky is a good choice because it has less forward voltage drop than most diodes, so it's less disruptive to getting signals across until suddenly, and without telling you, it doesn't anymore. Their surge protection amounts to the same thing as blowing fuses. A surge or spike blows the Schottky diode and breaks the connection. There are no built-in electronics to alert you to that, and really, when it's time to troubleshoot what went wrong with your internet or your phone line, is the backup power supply a place you would normally think to look? Also, when a UPS gets into any not-okay mode, it only has two ways of telling you. Either with something like idiot lights or a beeper or a display panel that's on the UPS, or with a companion app over a USB connection. I can think of a dozen ways it could be better about letting you know when they're in trouble, and I'll bet you can too. Speaking of that, think of anything and everything in your house that goes beep. The next time it needs to, it may not. You may already know that those little beeping tones are based on the piezoelectric flexing of skinny wafers. You may or may not know that those wafers are not immortal. They can shatter. The circuits therein tend to treat them like buzzers, but there are tons of things that can lead to failures, from an insensitive original circuit design to extremes in temperature or humidity or air pressure or impacts, even to sounding off so often that they buzz themselves to death. There are other ways to let things make noises, but few cost as little to manufacture as a piezo beeper. Do you own an AC voltmeter? Your power receptacle should have three holes, a long one, a short one, and a round one. Stay away from the short one. That's the hot lead. If you can do so safely, measure the AC voltage between the long slot, which is neutral, and the round hole, which is ground. It should be zero. Veteran electricians make it a practice to always ground the neutral lead. So those two should be connected. And if that's true for whoever wired your outlets, you should see 0 volts between neutral and ground. If you see anything else, be careful. It could mean a broken wire in your wall or another kind of problem. But the bigger issue is that a floating neutral, meaning one that isn't grounded, can become an unintended route into everything electrical in your house for events that you don't want them to see, from problems on the power line to backfed surges from lightning strikes. It would cost about a dime an outlet to build in an indicator of floating neutrals. I've seen plug-in testers, but nothing built into the outlet. If you have a heat pump, there's some thermostat or control wiring that feeds to the outdoor unit. Have you looked at it lately? Has anything been chewing at it? Most installers consider conduit too much of a bother, so those wires are often unprotected. You can get around that with those plastic spiral cord wraps. At least it gives the rodents something different to chew on and gives you a visible hint when they do. Anyway, it's a cheap trick that can at least delay a failure, if not absolutely prevent it. LED light bulbs, when they first came out, cost $40 to $60 each. Today, you can get them for less than $5. And the energy savings seems to make that a no-brainer. But some of the companies making LED bulbs take advantage of that voluntary abandonment of braininess. They cut a lot of corners. The good LED bulbs are rated for 25,000 hours. Some of the cheapest ones for 3,000 to 5,000 hours, 3 to 5,000 versus 25,000. The good ones with the same brightness as a 60-watt incandescent bulb should put out 800 lumens using 10 watts or less of power. The cheaters put out 650 to 700 lumens at 11 to 13 watts of power. So you get 650 to 700 instead of 800 lumens, and it's using 11 to 13 watts of power instead of 10 or less. A lot of the cheap ones will flicker, and some of them go dark in just a few weeks. To borrow a term from the past century, they're a jip. Buyer beware, especially when the difference is usually only $2 or $3. But there are bigger challenges in the next generation of LED lighting fixtures, with the light-emitting elements permanently integrated into the lighting housing, no bulbs to change, and often with a life expectancy of 50 years or more. But one challenge, and you folks especially have seen this happen throughout the history of technology, one challenge is that there's a gold rush that has nothing at all to do with delivering your best value, and everything to do with gaining your loyalty to a vendor's proprietary scheme for controlling things. Sound familiar? Okay, what's the best video cassette format, Beta or VHS? What's the best PC platform, Windows or OS 2? What's the best gaming platform, Atari or Commodore 64? What's the best smartphone platform, Android, BlackBerry, or iOS? Try never to mistake the people rushing to help themselves for people rushing to help you. LED fixture lighting isn't complicated. There's the thing that lights up because of the integrated LED emitters. There's the thing that provides that with power. It's almost always DC power. It's called a driver. And there's the thing that gets the driver to turn on or off or dim. It's called a controller. If you have an LED flashlight, think about this now, then you know that LEDs are DC devices. If a battery can do it, it's got to be DC. You could easily build a house with none of its light switches ever connected to the power lines because the switches and dimmers only ever really have to talk to the controllers. You may have seen businesses with button controls on the walls instead of traditional switches. What difference does that make? Well, for one thing, simple DC control feeds cost a lot less per foot than power wiring, and for another, things like controllers don't need extra devices to convert wall switch actions into signal levels. You lose cost and gain reliability, but the biggest brands know that once you understand the basics, you won't swallow the Kool-Aid in going with their proprietary systems. Just keep all this in mind if you're heading into a remodeling project or a new home build. I recommend you look at the DALI, DALI, the DALI standard, because it's been around for decades. It's reliable, it's easier to wire, and there's a huge catalog of products from multiple companies that are compatible with it. I have no idea if the people at Lowe's or Home Depot will know what you're talking about, so make sure you talk to somebody who doesn't think of DALI as an abstractionist or a child's toy. Besides, won't you feel foolish hopping aboard a proprietary standard and learning that you can't turn the lights on when your phone's dead? What is there in a house that's electric or electronic and will need replacing in less than 40 years? Well, TV sets, sure. Smoke alarms, phones, countertop appliances, laundry gear, hair dryers, irons. But what about the built-ins? You have some control there. A column-style refrigerator and a separate column freezer. That's a concept you can ask about at any appliance store. Column refrigerators and freezers have their own separate compressors and evaporators, and as a result, they run longer and are more energy efficient than refrigerator-freezer combinations. It may be possible, if you shop very, very carefully and do a lot of homework, to find choices that could conceivably endure for 40 years. By the way, that's unlikely to ever be true of a refrigerator-freezer combination unit. And the more features that are built into the door, the less efficient the insulation, meaning the less the energy efficiency, meaning it has to run that much harder and it will quit on you that much sooner. A built-in range or built-in oven is more likely to be good over the long haul if it's gas. Keep the burner ports open, do routine housekeeping and occasional professional checkups, and you can keep those going for a century with no major hassles, especially if you choose among better built units. Initially, they're more expensive, but they're a much better value in the long run. Every technology of electric ranges and ovens has one or another mechanism for failure in either the heating elements or the control systems, and manufacturers of those tend to limit how long replacement parts will still be available. For microwave ovens, I strongly urge you not to seek permanence or extreme longevity. Every time I turn around, those things are getting smarter and much better at using clever sensors and even more clever algorithms to be, well, if you think of it this way, really skilled cooks in their own regard. It's been a long time since I burned any kernels on the popcorn setting, and the reheat setting has had perfect results with almost any number of slices of leftover pizza, whether from the table or the fridge. So a lot of today's tech has room for improvement. A lot of the room for improvement is beyond the tech itself and in the attitudes of manufacturers and marketers toward what we consumers deserve. And even when it's only about computers and about Hank's eternal advice to back up, back up, back up, take that as meaning, yes, do your backups, but also look for ways to keep going if something with the backup goes wrong. And don't be afraid to, yes, back up for a second and reconsider whether your backup planning might have some room for improvement.
Thank you, Marty. Public service announcements. Computer club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, Tri-State region. Brookdale Computer User Group will be meeting Thursday, August the 23rd at 6:45 p.m. at the Middletown Library Lodge Community Room in Middletown Township Public Library at 55 New Monmouth Road in Middletown, New Jersey. Princeton PC User Group will have their general meeting Tuesday, August the 28th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. Community room at the Princeton Public Library, located at 65 Witherspoon Street in Princeton, New Jersey. Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey will have their meeting on Friday, September the 7th. Meeting time is 8 p.m. And they meet at the Scotch Plains Rescue Squad, 1916 Bartow Avenue, Scotch Plains, New Jersey. The New York Amateur Computer Club General Meeting is Thursday, September the 13th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. They meet at NYU, 32 Waverly Place, Silver Building in Manhattan, New York. Long Island Macintosh Users Group will have their meeting on Friday, September the 14th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. And they'll meet at the Harry J. Scherer Hall, New York Institute of Technology, located at Old Westbury Campus in Old Westbury, New York. All these meetings are free and open to the public. The computer clubs have random access sessions at each of these club meetings. If you have any questions or need some technical advice, the club members are more than happy to assist. Just remember, there is no such thing as a dumb question. And I have the following advice for computer club announcements. All the relevant information should be on the same page, preferably on the home page. And the computer club announcement should have the following: the name of the club, topic of presentation, if any, day of week, and the date of meeting and time, the venue of the meeting, and the location of the venue. Hey, we'll be seeing you at these meetings. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, on the internet, and at 9 p.m. Eastern Time on WBAI-FM 99.5 New York, on the radio, or WBAI.org, streaming on the internet. In the meantime, stay in touch and keep on computing, and remember, it's essential you back up. Just remember, three things you have to do: back up, back up, and back up. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King and Michael Horowitz, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy, and until we meet again, same time, same station, next week.